Okay, sure. Okay, guys. Let me start with basically it's going to be some psychological perspective on tshuva, and I'm going to talk about it. I think we'll see where it goes between now and the end. We'll speak about things in terms of the focus being on how to get through tough times. To the extent that the Ramchal tells us that part of life is lamod benisyonos. So the so to the extent that part of life is to literally that in some ways when we're focusing on some of the challenges in life, we're fulfilling our task in life. That's our meaning and purpose to a certain extent. To the extent that this 40-day period is a period of time that we're supposed to take a step back and figure out our goals and figure out our purpose and figure out and think about the bigger picture, which is really what this is all about. I don't know if there's any other religion that has a 40-day period like this, where there's a real turning into self and a reevaluation. You know, who do we have to apologize to? Where do we have to make things right? Where do we want to go? It's an incredible gift to be able to do that, and it's associated with all kinds of better outcomes in terms of the psychological research. So the three things I'm going to focus on are going to be some aspects on perspective. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about Shira, the role of Shira, of lack of words, the role of Shira in dealing with tough times, and then hopefully a little bit about optimism. So let me start with the first part I wanted to talk about. Is so in the last parsha of the year, of the year before we went into Rosh Hashanah, so there's an interesting pasuk that talks about tough times coming our way, talking about basically troubles finding us, umitzaahu. And then the lashon is ra'os rabos v'tzaros. So, in a brilliant, I think, insight on this, Rishach says, what's the difference between ra'os and tzaros? And I think that there's a tremendous amount of psychological wisdom to be gained by exploring it and helping us understand ourselves how to deal with tough times. Ra'os, Rishach says, is the objective facts. If something objectively bad happens, a family member is going through a tough time, there's illness, chas v'shalom, there's shalom bias problems in your home or in your parents' home, parnasa problems, there are so many things that could present us with ra'os. Tzaros, Rishach says, is the subjective meaning we give to the tough times. So it's the subjective meaning. Like, how do we process it? How do we process those tough times? So I'm going to share with you a couple of experiences I've had, and where people, in some cases, transformed the ra'os to tzaros in a way that was extremely helpful, and sometimes not. Because it's all in, as the Baal Shem Tov would say, b'makom shemachshavto shel adam sham hu nimtza ha'esh. Okay, you want to know where a person is? Look at where his or her thoughts are. So here's my first ra'os to tzaros story. I was at a weekend for families whose husbands were in jail. This wonderful organization called Dror, run by these amazing Balei Chesed in the Chassidish community. And I was there for a Shabbaton, for a Shabbos. They don't call it a Shabbaton. They call it Shabbos, okay? Okay? And Chesed in these communities blow me away. Here they had hundreds of people just there to give chizuk to the children whose fathers are now in jail, some of them with sentences of 50 years and beyond. Some of them for shorter periods of time. You can imagine what it does to a child and in terms of the issues, be it shidduchim or be it just problems with having nobody to help you with your Limudei Kodesh work. It's incredibly difficult. And the wives who are going through an incredibly tough time now as single parents. So one of the main guys who organized this wonderful organization, who organized Dror, he was just schmoozing with me on Friday night. And he tells me the following. He says, you know, a couple of months ago, I had an amazing experience. He said, I heard about somebody, who was literally, literally about to die unless she could get a new kidney. So I figured, okay, you know, I'd see if I was a match. And he says, an amazing thing. I was a perfect match for this woman. As a perfect, perfect match. Okay? So I, of course, I, you know, arranged to have my kidney removed, to give it to this woman, and was literally going to save her life. So I'm in the hospital, about to give my kidney, and by some unbelievable hashkacha, right around that time, my mother is diagnosed with kidney cancer, he tells me. And very operable, very contained, but it meant she had to have her kidney removed. So the hospital hears about this. They hear, look, there's a son and a mother in the exact same surgery in the same hospital, so they put their rooms next to each other. So here's what he tells me. He says, let me explain to you the experience for me. Think about this in terms of Rav Shach's transforming the ro'os to tsaros and that the subjective perspective shift of this amazing man. He said that week that I was in the hospital recovering, he said, was beyond a shadow of a doubt the happiest week of my life. He said it was unbelievable. He said, do you know what simcha comes with literally knowing that you're able to take somebody who is literally about to die and to save their lives? He said, I was besimcha like you couldn't imagine. He said, it was unbelievable. He said, my mother in the next room had the exact same surgery. Exactly the same surgery. For her, it was probably one of the worst weeks of her life. She was depressed. She was experiencing tremendous pain. She was frightened. She was literally in a place of deep, deep tsaros. He says, so the very same thing that for me was the source of the greatest simcha, for her was the source of the greatest pain. That's what Rav Shach means. That's what the last few psukim that we learned on the last Shabbos of the year before Rosh Hashanah. Going from ro'os to tsaros. It's all how we see it. So that's example number one. Example number two is something that comes from me. I don't even know if it was an arrogance. I don't think that today I'm older and wiser, but it was something that you can only do when you're young and don't know what you're doing. Okay? But let me tell you this story. When I was starting my career, so I was very lucky to get a wonderful job at North Shore Hospital. Today it's this Northwell system of, I don't know, dozens of hospitals, you know, dominating the East Coast in many ways, dominating certainly the New York area. But so I was there and I was just starting. So where do they put people who were just starting? They put me to be the psychologist for the pediatric hematology oncology unit. So I was put in this unit for kids with cancer, to work with kids with cancer. The reason they did that is nobody wanted that job. And back then, this is a long time ago, this is in the late 70s, I'm old, it was back then, when you had cancer, the prognosis was terrible. So you were literally, now Baruch Hashem, it's turned from a terminal illness to a chronic illness and to an often completely curable illness. It's amazing what happened in the last decades. But back then, it was a very, very stressful thing. So around the same time, there's a man named Alan Strohmeyer. Now, Alan Strohmeyer, only people here who are really heavily into certain kinds of music would know this. He was the guitarist. I don't know if he was the lead guitarist, but he was the guitarist for Aerosmith. Okay? He was the guy. Any real Aerosmith fans here? Okay, so if you look on their early records, early albums, you'll see Alan Stromeyer. But back then, it was around the time of Vietnam. They were very heavily into drug abuse, and they were likely to be drafted into Vietnam. And he said to himself, "If I don't stop this drug abuse, okay, either one of two things are going to happen. I'm going to die of an overdose. I'm not going to survive. And not only will I not survive," he said, "but it's almost certain that I'm going to end up in Vietnam, and nothing good's going to happen to me in Vietnam. He said, I just have to leave." He's a very bright guy. And he left Aerosmith, which I think he's often regretted that decision. This is, I think, just before they signed a $40 million contract, but whatever. He left Aerosmith. He's still connected to them, but only as friends. He gets great tickets, okay? But he gets a full scholarship to Rockefeller, right? Isn't Rockefeller still the place where I think more Nobel laureates than any place, maybe except Israel? But Rockefeller, that building, not too far from here, it's an amazing place. He goes to Rockefeller, and he's on the team that is the first team to develop biofeedback. So they develop biofeedback. So I was schmoozing with him about this problem that they were facing, because one of the very first consultations I was asked to get involved in was there was a six-month-old baby with cancer. And she was extremely cute. But she had a cry that was almost nonstop and that cut right through you like a knife. Because there was something about her pain and her crying that was unbelievably painful to everybody. Her parents were burning out. The nurses were burning out, and the doctors were burning out. And they were just telling, when I was consulting with the team, they said, "Look, we know you can't do anything about this. We just want you to know about this. We're going crazy. If you have any ideas, we'll appreciate it." Okay? So I had an idea. Okay? I'm talking to Alan Stromeyer, and I say, "How about if tonight, can you take some of your biofeedback equipment from Rockefeller? Okay? We'll get permission." We didn't really tell the parents or the medical staff what we were doing, because we wanted to make sure this would happen. And we go into the hospital late at night, and we hook the baby up as she's crying. And what Alan was able to show, what Dr. Stromeyer was able to show, the more she cried, the calmer she got. The most piercing screams, the most piercing, heart-wrenching cries were bringing down her galvanic skin response, her blood pressure, her pulse rate. Every physiologic measure of stress was getting better from what? From the crying. Tears release stress hormones. Tears of that kind are good for you. The next day, we gather the parents and the doctors and the nurses around the little girl. Dr. Stromeyer hooks her up with the biofeedback equipment. And it was amazing what we saw. Okay? We showed them. Look, it's making her feel better. It's transforming the sorrows to the rose. From that point on, every time that baby cried, the parents would say, "Oh, Baruch Hashem," figuratively would say it. The doctors would say, "Oh, she's feeling better." It took that stimulus, it took that incredibly upsetting event, and it changed it into a source of real nechama. Nechama, as we know from Rav Hirsch and from Rav Schwab, a shift in perspective. And from Rashi on the first time it says nechama in the Torah, ki nichamti ki asisim, a shift in perspective. So that's the second example of what that's about. So what am I talking about here? How do you bring this into your regular life? How do you bring this into the challenge during this 40-day period of thinking, how am I going to deal with that aspect of life, the Lama Besaros aspect of life? And the bottom line is, with everything, we could choose what we're going to focus on. We could choose whether to focus on the positive or focus on the negative. We could choose whether or not to see anything that comes our way is going to be a source of focus in a way that will bring us to growth, okay? Or a focus that will literally pull us down. It's a choice. No matter what, it's a choice. We all know many stories of examples where people have done it. I've been amazed sometimes it's survivors, Holocaust survivors, who have been unbelievable in the way that they were able to squeeze out, in terms of their Rose Kitzaros transformation, something that they could focus on that would bring them simcha and growth even in the most horrible place in the history of the world. You know, some of you may have heard about the work of Dr. Salovey. How many of you know about the work of Dr. Salovey at Yale? Okay, so for those of you who don't know it, it's amazing work. Dr. Salovey is today the president of Yale, a very prominent psychologist. And he developed his career partly on this issue that we're talking about, really on how do you take Ra'os and transform it to Tzaros, where you have a perspective that's a growth perspective. And what he found, he did a whole series of studies that really was about transforming Goral to Yud, right? Goral, as the Rav would say, okay? So Goral is basically that you feel like you're in a passive place, a log floating on the river at the mercy of the current. That's Goral. That, Dr. Salovey shows, is associated with higher levels of depression. You don't do as well in dealing with the tzaros in life. You just don't do well. It's associated with all kinds of bad stuff. When you're able to transform it from Goral to Yud, saying, hey, this is my destiny. Let's see if I could grow from this. Okay? So Dr. Salovey showed in a series of studies that when you help people see their tzaros as a source of growth, it's transformative. One of the classic studies he talks about is the hotel maid study. So the hotel maid study goes like this. They take a bunch of hotel maids in a hotel chain, and they're randomly assigned to two groups. Group number one does their regular hotel maid thing. It's not exactly the most enjoyable and wonderful job in the world, but you do it because you have to make a living. The other half are randomly assigned to a group. They meet with them. They say, listen, guys, you were part of a very important wellness study. We want to understand wellness in the workplace. Here's what we want you to do. When you make a bed, you take the sheets, okay? And it's really a workout, okay? So you throw out the sheets, 1, 2, 3, you tuck them into the mattress, 4, 5, 6, you then flatten them out, 7, 8, 9, it's an aerobic workout. When you're vacuuming, concentrate on what that action is doing to your upper and lower biceps. And they took every single thing, dusting, cleaning out a bathroom, cleaning out a toilet, everything, and they changed it into wellness. Okay? It's wellness. Here's the purpose. You're doing something important. You're helping us understand wellness in the workplace. They did exactly the same thing that the control group mates did. You know that after 6 months, just from that difference, the way you see it, the way you see your perspective on that aspect of your job, the women in the wellness group, okay, lost a lot of weight. They went from feeling depressed to feeling happy. Every measure they had of those women, they were transformed by that shift in perspective. They were transformed by that shift in perspective. Literally, going from a place of Goral, I have no control over my life, to a place of Yid. Now, you all know who Dr. Salovey is. What's Salovey short for, everybody? The president of Yale? Soloveitchik, right? It's his cousin who spoke about Goral versus Yud. He's also a descendant of the Brisker dynasty, okay? Now he's becoming increasingly interested, I think, in his Jewish background. He has a brother who I'm friendly with who's Baal Tshuv, a wonderful, wonderful member of the Frum community. He's becoming, I think, more interested in this. But Dr. Salovey, basically, I don't know how these things happen. He developed a world-renowned research career that ultimately catapulted him to the president of the university. I think that was ranked, number one, number two. It's certainly one of the top universities of the world in the most recent kind of rankings. How that happens, that they came up with the same concept, one doing research and the other doing, my father calls it ancestral alchemy. There's something going on in terms of certain ways of thinking that we don't quite understand, but they came up with the exact same ways of thinking. And just to end this section, I'll end it with a beautiful thought I heard from Rabbi Hauer, a good friend of mine, a colleague of mine. We spend a lot of time working on different projects together. He's a Rav in Baltimore. So Rabbi Hauer told once the High Lifeline retreat. So Rabbi Hauer was talking about the Akedah. It's a group of parents who have a kid with cancer. And he had a shift, one shift in words, that changed their psychological experience of having a kid with cancer. Years later, when I talked to them, they say, remember when Rabbi Hauer said this? Here's what he said. He's talking about that kid. He says, imagine the Ayil Nechaz B'Sfach. Imagine that ram caught in the thistle. That ram created Bein Hashmashos on the first Friday. Okay? He says, there are two ways of looking at that ram in the story of that Akedah. You could see the ram as stuck, or you could see it as positioned. You could see the ram as stuck, or you could see it as positioned. If you want to know practical things to do in terms of the transformation of Ra'os to Tzaros in a way that is yiyud and growth-inducing, see any tough time you're going through. It's your position. There's a reason for this. You're going to grow from it. Whereas that magnificent Medrash Tehillim says, that to me is one of my favorite pieces of deep, deep thought in the sources on this, is Ilu nafalti lo kamti, ilu yashavti b'choshech lo hayarli. If I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. If I never sat in the darkness, I wouldn't have appreciated the light. So in terms of these two opening stories, right? What happened there? What happened to that Hasidish guy giving his kidney? It was a source of growth. He literally was feeling positioned. I'm saving somebody's life. His mother, not so much. And in terms of the story of that medical staff and the way they were helped by Dr. Strohmeyer's intervention, okay, it was amazing. It was amazing. They literally were helped to go from a place of stuck to a place of position, seeing it in a completely different way, transforming the Ra'os into Tzaros in a positive way that brings you to a yiyud place. We're good? Part one? We're okay? Okay, let's move on. Next thing I wanted to talk about is the issue of Shira. Right? So what's the 613th mitzvah in the Torah, everybody? Yeah, right. What does it say? Say it again. Kiss, right. It's Kiss Vilchem Sashirosos. Literally, it's number 613, right? Okay, and that's what Hazinu is, according to the Ramban, whatever. That's Hazinu is that. Or I think according to most of the Farshim. So I want to talk a little bit about Shira as a source of Nechama, as a source of going through stress, which is basically, what's the role of art, of music, of writing, of all those, but in this case, of the nonverbal in dealing with tough times. So let me start with a beautiful thought I heard from Rabbi Dr. David Fox about one of his rabbis, psychologist and Rav in California, and a dayan in the Rishalayim, Batei Dinan. While he's back and forth between the places, because they use him, I think, on any cases having to do with the specialty areas, which is anything having to do with mental health. Brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham. I think he has multiple smichas. He's an unbelievable guy to know. So listen to what he shared with me once. He's talking about the meaning of dancing and of music in tough times. So I'll read to you what he sent me once. Our times of glory have been animated and elevated by a reflex of unity and celebration in song and dancing. This is embedded in our soul and in our collective memory. Rav Pinchas Katz relates the following story that he heard from one of his rebbeim. As the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, closed in on the shul in one of the large German cities, the men in the congregation broke from their typical, stately, composed style and spontaneously clutched hands and danced gracefully, slowly, in a circle. No one planned it. No one seemed to know what had motivated it, other than some deeply embedded sense that this was the way to give honor to God in that final moment before capture, torture, and deportation. This is the essence of the Jewish dance. It's somehow embedded in our collective DNA to respond in this nonverbal way with the closeness and the togetherness and the connection and without words. It was the song, and we all know many stories about that. I know you know the story. I heard this story almost sounds made up, but I heard this from the Rav of some of the men who experienced this story. You know the story in a concentration camp on Simchas Torah, a group of, I don't remember, it was 30, 40 guys were put into the gas chambers. And they're about to be gassed to death on Simchas Torah. I don't remember. There's another story. I think they might have been Panovich boys. Whatever it was. I don't remember that detail. And they join hands because it's Simchas Torah, and they start singing and dancing. Literally, as they're being crushed in, and they know it's the last seconds of their lives, and they're singing and dancing. The Nazi, who was in charge of looking through the glass to observe and make sure that everybody died, gets furious. He stops the execution, calls out all of these men, and he says, "How dare you? How dare you?" And basically, how dare you transform this into something that you're dancing? We're about to kill you. How dare you do this? And he says, you know what? This death in a gas chamber, it's too good for you. We're going to figure out a way to really, really give you a slower and more agonizing death. And he puts them into some kind of a holding cell or a prison to get ready for that execution, which I think was going to be the next day. It was going to be Istruchad. And somehow, it was a time of chaos. I don't know if there was some bombings by the... I know it might have been the end of the war. I don't remember every detail. What I do know is that there was some confusion. There were some attacks. Things were not necessarily going so well for the Nazis at that time, thank God. And in the chaos, somehow these men were not... Not only were they not executed, but they ended up having their lives saved. And they went on. I think they ended up going to yeshiva. I don't know if they ended up in Panovich, but they all ended up together as a group. And I heard this story from their Rav in Brooklyn. I was giving a talk on a similar topic to what we're talking about tonight, this morning. And he said, you know, these people in my shul who are from these people. He said, I heard this directly from the survivors who experienced this. Okay, it's that power. Okay, let's go on in terms of going on with sharing. I'm going to share some beautiful stuff I heard from Dr. Blumenthal. Many of you know Dr. Blumenthal. You don't know Dr. Blumenthal. Dr. Blumenthal is, we both teach pastoral psychology here, pastoral psychology 1 and 2. And then he does other stuff. We've been working together for many, many years. And he's okay. He's okay. He's a brilliant expert in bereavement and very, very talented. He's the guy who runs the OHEL bereavement work. He does unbelievable work with people going through. If there's a crisis anywhere in the world where there's class to show them there's loss, he gets on a plane, he goes there, and he guides people through how to deal with this, with these tragedies. So listen to. I got this from Dr. Blumenthal. So he has an Abarbanel that he loves. Listen to this Abarbanel, and listen to this aspect of Shiras. The Abarbanel on Vayidom Aharon. Okay, so here's what he says: Avol Pirush Vayidom Aharon, who shenepach libo v'hoya ke'evan dome. That at this horrible news, his heart was transformed into silent stone. Lo nasa kol b'chi u'b'mispeit. He couldn't cry. He was beyond tears. He didn't respond the way you would expect a father to respond upon the loss of his children. Gamlo kibel tanchumim mimoshe. He couldn't accept tanchumim from Moshe. Okay? Because kilo nosra bo neshama v'adivarein bo. You know, many years ago, a little bit after 9/11, I was working with this world-renowned psychiatrist. His name was Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. Again, a Harvard psychiatrist. Now he's a professor at BU. He's one of the leading guys in the world on trauma. We were collaborating on some research together. And he was in New York for a bit, working with me on some articles we were writing. And he comes he's the sugar loaf lover when it comes to trauma and loss. He comes running into my office, David, look what I have. And he shows me an fMRI, picture of the brain of one of his patients, happened to have been a psychiatrist, who was stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center on 9/11. Literally stuck. And by some miracle got away with his life. And he's showing me, what does this man's brain look like on this fMRI at the moment that he's having a flashback to the worst moment of his life? What does his brain look like? And I look at it, I'll tell you, the two words that flashed through my head the second I saw it, Vayidom Aharon. Because Broca's area was shut down. You know what happens to your brain when a horrible thing is happening? Here this guy is about to die, and he's reliving it as if it's now. Your language centers shut down exactly like the Barbanel said so many centuries ago. Okay? Literally, Broca's area shuts down. You know where the refuah comes in terms of take-home messages on this? It comes from lighting up Broca's area. In subsequent scans, Dr. van der Kolk showed me that as he saw the psychiatrist in therapy, and he gave him words for his pain and meaning and purpose and help with going from Ra'os to Tzaros in a positive way. And as he named the monster, his refuah came from that, from lighting up the language centers of the brain. Okay, that's that. That's that piece. It's a fascinating thing to think about. But now we're talking about Shira. So let me tell you what Dr. Blumenthal shared with me in terms of wordless connecting. Listen to this. It's from a book called The Natural History of the Piano. Guy named Stuart Isakoff. And it's a story about one of the Talmidim of Beethoven. Okay? Listen to this story. Because it's the answer to what that Barbanel brings up, and it's the answer to all of this in terms of this component. And it shows the power of Shira. Listen to this. In 1804, the pianist Dorothea Ertmann, who had studied Beethoven's works with the composer, lost her young son. Mrs. Ertmann was so stricken that for weeks she was unable to weep. We talked about the power of tears a few minutes ago. We talked about with that baby, how tears release stress hormones. Tears is part of the refuah, not part of the machla, when you have that kind of emotional tears. She couldn't weep. Like Lahavdil, like Aharon. It's beyond tears. It's like an Even Domain. Hearing of her grief, Beethoven invited her to his house to offer his condolences, though he didn't say a word. Beethoven did not open his mouth, like Eov in the first Shiva, where his friends didn't say a word. He played for more than an hour, Stuart Isakoff tells us, until Ertmann began to sob. When she told the stories years later to Felix Mendelssohn, she said that Beethoven's playing, open quotes, told me everything and at last brought me comfort. The power of Shira, the power of music, the power of what Hazinu is all about, and the power of Torah, the Shira of Torah. You know, you look at a Torah, and you look at the places in the Torah where there's Shira. You look at Az Yashir, you look at Hazinu. What does it look like, everybody? What does it look in the Torah? What do the words look like? Wide open, right? There's a wide open space. For sure, it was my Rosh Yeshiva when I was in Tar Hadas, who used to send me buy his cigarettes, which just showed you my role in pecking. This guy could afford to miss learning because he's not learning so much. And it was true. So for sure, I was the guy who used to buy him the cigarettes that unfortunately led him having a shorter life. For sure, said brilliantly in Ar Gedalia, he says, what is that all about? He says, it's all about giving space for our neshama to breathe. It gives us space. We need space. We need to be able to somehow create the space And it's what's between the words that gives our neshama the chiyus and the basically the instruments for being able to find the chama and the shift in perspective that Dr. Soloveit talks about. So that's almost the end. I'm going to tell you a story, although many of you may have heard this story, but you're going to get chazorah for those of you who heard this story. But it's my favorite single story on this topic, and I learned a tremendous amount from it. And it has to do with Machlokas three times in Bavli between Rav Amin Ravasi and Dagab Levish Yashchena. You have a worry in your heart, it says in Mishle, and the word is Yashchena. And what does it mean? Machlokas is Chadam Yashchena Midata. One man Damer says it's Hesach Hadas, it's distraction. Shin B'Samach Mishalfen. So one man Damer says you have a worry in your heart, distract yourself. That's what men specialize in, 80% of men. V'Chadamar Yashchena Lachem. Another man Damer says, Talk it out. Light up Broca's area. Light up the language centers of the brain. Interestingly, it doesn't say anywhere that Rav Ami is right, Ravasi is right. It doesn't say that anywhere. So listen to this amazing story. And this, I think, is probably the most important take-home message in terms of Rav Ami and Ravasi coming alive after a terror attack in Yerushalayim. Listen to what happens. In the height of the Second Intifada, My main research area, my main clinical area, before I was stolen to come here, was trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. I did a lot of work and research and clinical work, in PTSD. So I was involved in developing the DSM-4 iteration of the diagnosis, and then later on some other diagnostic stuff. So I was very immersed in that. And because of that, I'd get called to different parts of the world when there were different kinds of traumatic events. And I was called to Eretz Yisrael a lot during the Second Intifada because the Ein Kol V'Shema Eretz Yisrael Mibeis Esther, and people couldn't think clearly for themselves. So I was asked to spend a couple of weeks in the height of the Second Intifada in Yerushalayim. And I was giving different lectures, and I was working with people, for example, the death notification people, the psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers would have to go and tell people, knock on their door and say, your father was just killed, your son, your wife, your sister. They had to do it. They had to give the news, and then they just stay with the people. And these people were burning out. It was probably the worst job in the world. And they needed somebody outside. They knew much more about trauma than I'll ever know. But I was spending time there, and I was giving a talk to this team, about 40 mental health professionals, in the Jerusalem Trauma Center, directed by Dr. Danny Brahm, who some of you may know from Herzog Hospital. So we were talking, and I'm showing a PowerPoint, and the call comes in about the bombing in the Frank Sinatra cafeteria, where about, 9 people were killed, 7 of them were Americans. It was huge news here also. It would be huge news here anyway, but the fact was it was 7 Americans who were killed because it was in the Frank Sinatra cafeteria on the Hebrew University campus. If you ever go onto that campus, you'll see a big monument to that bombing. People calling that bombing. Immediately, the phone's ringing all over. From all over the country, people requesting help from the therapist I was talking to. The room clears out. I'm left alone in the room. We weren't so far from where the bombing was. And you hear the ambulances. You could even... It's just literally, we were there. We were very close. And we're just, shocked. We're shell-shocked. And phone rings again. There's a camp in the middle of the country where a very beloved staff member had been killed. They just identified her. And they don't have any therapists left. So the director of the clinic asked me and my colleague, the assistant director of the clinic, who's since has become a very famous trauma expert, Dr. Ruth Paterensik, we go. He says, go to the middle of the country to where this camp is. We got lost on the way, and your brother, Rabbi Willig, we knocked on the door. Your brother answered, unless it was you. Somebody, some Willig answered the door. It was just Hashkocha, and they told us how to get to the camp. Okay? But... So we're there. We go to the camp, and I figured, well, do what we do in America. No Israelis going to let an American tell them what to do. They put me and my colleague in the corner of the room. We were supposed to tell the kids the terrible news and spend the day with them. The brilliant camp director said, look, tell them the horrible news. He says, we have 5 coping rooms. It's literally Rav Ami and Ravasi coming alive millennia later. Okay? We have 5 coping rooms. One room was a room, he tells them, you could write letters. Okay? Write letters to the parents of this wonderful woman about what an amazing woman she was. The other room was a davening room. The other room was an art room. The other room was the music room. It was the shira room. And the fifth room was the talking room for us. The kids were told they could go from room to room throughout the day. And no kids, not a single kid, left the room they were in. They divided themselves exactly equally between four of the five rooms. Anybody want to guess what room nobody chose? Huh? Very good. Very good. Most people don't get that. Davening. Most people say talking. But you get a prize. You get a prize. You can help yourself to an extra muffin outside. Okay? So, davening now could be because they were in a psychological state of aninus. It wasn't ready for tefillah. It could be for other reasons. Could be because they were teenagers. You know, it could have been for a lot of reasons. But the talkers talked, and the music kids did music. This is before Apple made their change the world of music. There were Sony Walkman they were listening to, and there were some musical instruments. And the writers wrote. And so what was it again, everybody? It was music, art, talking, writing, and tefillah, right? Okay, so I learned a tremendous amount. The next week or so, I'm back in New York, and it was the first anniversary, as I remember it, of 9/11. And I was asked to give a talk about, I was very involved after 9/11 with working with many family members who lost their immediate family in the World Trade Center. And I was asked to give a talk. And a woman comes over to me afterwards, and she says the following. This, I'll end this section, the section on Shira. She says, my father was a vicious chassid in the concentration camp, and his bunkmate was Elie Wiesel. And he's still alive, she said. He's living with me. And Dr. Wiesel was giving a lecture in Manhattan, right here in the city, the week before I gave the 9/11 memorial talk to some group here in New York. And she said she was leaving her house to go hear Dr. Wiesel. And he calls her over and says, look, he says, you know, you're going to see my old friend Ellie. She said, I haven't spoken to him in all that time. You know, you could tell him we're all so proud of him. He'd already won the Nobel Prize. He was like... he says, we're all so proud of him. He says, but I don't even know if he'll remember me. It's been so many years. So she wants to keep it off. She waits online after Elie Wiesel's talk, and she says, look, you know, my father doesn't know if you remember him, but his name is so-and-so, and he remembers you fondly, and he's just extremely proud of everything you accomplished. Immediately, Professor Wiesel, tears, all of a shalom, tears. You know, he put on tefillin every day, every weekday. You know, he was a fully from Jew. I don't know if anybody here knew him. He was an amazing, remarkable man. But anyway, Elie Wiesel says, in response to her question, he's not sure of him, he says, not remember your father? He never told you that anything I've accomplished is because of him? That shali shalo, anything I've done, it's him. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your father. She says, what are you talking about? He never said anything. He says, let me tell you what happened. He says, there was a day that was horrible even by concentration camp survivors. We were in a state of total yush. We'd given up. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison. And they went online, and they took the poison, and they lay down to die. Adolescence is a time that suicide is very contagious. He said, everybody, all the adolescents in that section of the camp, we all looked at each other and we said, you know something? They have a point. They're torturing us anyway. They're going to kill us anyway. Let's go. Let's take the rat poison. He said, every adolescent in that section of the camp went online. And he said, we were fully intending to make that our last minutes on this earth. He said, everybody went online except your father, the chassid. He retained his chassidus even in that horrible place. And your father goes to the side of the line, and he breaks into the ancient Vishnitsanigan of Ani Mamin B'Emuna Shleima B'Vias HaMashiach. He says, that song, it broke our suicidal spell. One by one, Every one of us left the line. We formed a circle. We held your father's hand and we danced. We danced, the dance I just spoke about, that Rabbi Dr. Fox talks about. And we sung the Animamen. He says, go home and tell your father that that nigun is the reason we're all still here today. The power of Shira. The power of the space between the words. The power of that aspect of what we learn this time of year in terms of getting support. Let me end with a few words on optimism. And then maybe we'll have a little bit of time if you're in the mood for questions, okay? So here's a few words on optimism. As you know, we already talked about, you know, we all know that when you could use your brain and when you can make a choice to focus on what you have instead of what you don't have, you do better with everything in life. Hakara Satov is so central, so amazingly central to who we are and what we do, to our role as a Jew. Do you know that Rav Huttner, in, I think it's in Pachad Yitzchak, there's a piece which was authored by, not authored, it was written down by Rabbi Dr. Feuerman, Zecher Tzaddik Levracha, was just nifter last week. And, a lot of everything I say came from him. We're all still reeling from his tira. After teaching the last class of the Jewish year, he went back to his car here in parking lot E, and after having an amazing, amazing life, it was nifter in the last minutes of, you know, just in time to have a proper kfura just before Rosh Hashanah. So the ability to focus on the positive. So Pachad, and he by the way, how many volumes of Pachad Yitzchak did he put together? But he told me, I mean, there's a whatever. Anyway, he was the Talmud Nufuk of Rav Huttner. Anyway, so the power of gratitude, Rav Huttner talks about how he quotes a Maharal. Maharal says that, let's say you know somebody who's a kafui tov, somebody who doesn't show the proper gratitude when you help them out. He says it's usur to do something for them. You're not allowed to do something that they should be grateful for if you know that their tendency is to show no gratitude for what you do. He says, why? Because then, the Maharal says, if you do something nice for them and they don't say thank you, you're bringing fear into the world and you're over on lefneiva. He says, you just can't do anything nice for them. So that's the power of gratitude. Well, what psychology tells us over and over again, that if you want to know how to deal with tough times, being able to focus on what you have is probably the single most potent kind of psychological activity you could do. I could keep you here for all day with just that. But let me just share with you one story, and then we'll do Vidui Hamashlam. Okay? So here's the story. The story is that I have a friend. They're the Betones from Queens, the doctor couple. She's an endocrinologist, and he's an ophthalmologist. And I was giving a talk in their shul, scholar residence in their shul in Hillcrest. And I was talking a little bit about optimism and the power of optimism, telling some stories about it as such an incredibly important mida to develop. And I'm walking home from shul, they were my hosts, and Dr. Betone tells me, he says, let me tell you something. You could say that we could develop this. He says, I don't believe you. He says, you're either born with it or you're not born with it. And he tells me the following story about his wife. He says, about his mother. He says, his mother was known as probably the youngest person to ever get into Auschwitz and to survive. And she always told him the following story. She said, she was a little girl. I forget exactly how old she was, but she was extremely little. But he said, she just had an inborn optimism and simchas hachaim. Somehow, miraculously, they choose her to go to work. So she's waiting for the tattoo. And she tells herself, I'm going to have a very long life. have a very long life. I want to have the best looking tattoo I could have, because that's going to be on my arm for the rest of my life. He said she goes there, she looks at the lines of the various people, or the various Jews waiting for the tattoo. So she goes behind the longest line. She tells herself the longest line must be the most meticulous tattoo artist. And he says, if you ever meet my mother, and she's become a very famous author of many books about her experience in the camps, a brilliant woman. He says, ask to see her tattoo. He says, it is unbelievably the best tattoo I've ever seen of any survivor. Could you imagine even thinking that way or talking that way? That's inborn optimism. You know what? We know you can develop this in yourself. I didn't agree with them. We have all kinds of ways of teaching people optimism. People always have a choice on whether or not to focus on what they have instead of what they don't have. And I'm going to end now with a beautiful, beautiful thought. I don't know if anybody wants to take this and give it out or something, because a lot of people... I say this on Yom Kippur along with regular vidui. Many shuls. I gave a similar talk to this Young Israel Jamaica States just on Sleepless Night, and they're giving it out to the whole shul. People who hear this want to use it. So let me tell you what it is. First, let me tell you what it comes from. So this is, Rav Cook. So he says the following. This is a Maseches Maser Sheni, Perek Zayin Mishnah Yud. Al Kain. Kishem sheyesh toeles gedola l'tikun hanefesh bevidui havonos. Just like it's extremely important to be misaken our neshama and to have the tikun that we're going to be going into in Mir Hashem tomorrow night. Tomorrow night on vidui havonos. Gam came bevidui hamitzvos. He says, you know something? We should also have vidui hamitzvos. Why only focus on Avonus, that's important. But we also have to focus on the good we've done. L'man yismach behem bilvavo, to gladden our heart. You know, when you're happy and you focus on the positive, there's some brand new research that shows, do you know that it's the harchavas, what's the lashon there? You know, that if you have a beautiful house and a beautiful wife and a beautiful surroundings, what's the word? Rachvas?
Yeah, yeah,
what's the word? Huh?
Yeah, rachvas.
It's an expansive, right? So there's some new research that just came out. I just saw a couple of days ago that showed that literally, when you focus on the positive, your sphere of vision widens and expands, and you see more. Your peripheral vision improves, and they show with this really well done research that literally you see more when your heart expands with focusing on the good. And then he goes on to say. So you focus on the positives. L'man yismach be'bavav yachseik orchos chayav v'derech Hashem. Here's the vidui hamashlam. Okay, I'm going to say it. Ahavnu, we have loved. Bachinu, we have cried. Gamalnu, we have done good. Dibarnu yofi. Okay. Heeminu, v'hishtadalnu, we've tried. Zacharnu, chibaknu. Ta'amnu sefer. Yatsarnu. Kamahanu. Kamahanu is a very interesting word that Rabbi Hochberg showed me a source from the Ksav HaKabbalah that shows that it's tied to the word, the shorsh of the word in Vahavta Recha Kamocha. It means to literally have goosebumps of anticipation for something good. You're so excited from the shorsh of Chaf Mem Hey. Goosebumps of anticipation. We've been so happy for others that we felt it. We've tingled physically with happiness for others. Lachamnu avor hatzedek, right? Mitzinu es hatov, nisinu, we tried. Sarnu liros, not so easy. Asinu asher tzivisanu, peirashnu, sadaknu lefamen, karanu b'shimcha, ratzinu, samachnu tamachnu. Isn't that beautiful? Will make you feel better on Yom Kippur. I know you should feel better, but anyway, if anybody wants it, it's yours. Okay, I'm done. Okay, so we have, I know you could go, but if anybody feels like talking for the last 5 minutes, or asking a question, or anything like that, feel free, or we should just call, yeah, please.
Can you think of the example of, for example, like a wellness exercise that you told me about?
perspective. So if someone's going through a hard time, should we like trick ourselves into thinking there's some, like, they were told that they were going to run this experiment. So like when we're going through a hard time, we should like tell ourselves that there's something better.
Yeah, and that's a good question. I think the idea there is when you're going through a hard time, the real point was is they saw a purpose in it. They saw a growth. It changed their perspective on their job to seeing something positive. So you see, to the extent that you could go. It's again, Dr. Salovey calls it post-traumatic growth. What growth could I get out of this? And by the way, there's growth in everything. Nobody wishes it on themselves. But I can tell you many, many stories of people who have literally, I once had a kid with cancer in a group I was doing at a Camp Simcha, a Chai Lifeline retreat, and he just lost his leg to a Ewing sarcoma. And he's sitting down with a group of other adolescents, and he says, "See, you know, I lost my leg." He's sitting in his wheelchair. He'd had the surgery relatively recently. He says, "You know something?" He said, "Before I lost my leg, I didn't have a family. My parents were involved in their work. My siblings had nothing to do with me. Since my surgery, I have a family. My parents are with me nonstop. My siblings are reconnected to me." He says, "You know what? It would be worth even the other leg." He says, "Now that's weird. But that's an example of being able to see the growth opportunities and the Iluna Falti Lo Kamti, which Dr. Salovey shows is associated with good outcomes." Everybody, yeah, please.
Sorry, just one quick last thing. You spoke at the end about focusing on the good specific that you remember and the good stuff that you did. So how do you balance positive thinking with obviously regretting the past and feeling bad about it? Obviously, I guess.
Yeah, excellent point. Right, and it's interesting because I did an all day session on that at an OL clinical conference. I'm thinking about Eretz Yisrael and again in November. That's extremely important. You're right. I'm glad you made that point. It's a balance. You need to be able to talk about the bad also. You need to be able to, in a valid way, talk about the bad. There's a whole new field called positive psychotherapy that takes the wisdom of positive psychology and the research in positive psychology, which is a very Jewish subdiscipline of clinical psychology, and to learn how to use it for growth of trauma. So there's a whole explosion of understanding how to find that balance. And there's a beautiful review, Ruchem, on that, that talks about, and with this I'll really end, Kamasa Livnes Asapir, talking about Hashem's footstool. So Yochum Levavit says, Ma inyan shibud lachar hagula. Okay? Here we're talking about that embedded in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's footstool is a brick, Seicher L'Shibud Mitzrayim. He says, what after the gula, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu need a memory of the tough times? What's that about? Who knows what that even means? So he says, you know why? It's to teach us for all time that when we've been through a bad time, okay, you have to balance your gratitude and focus on the light, that you have to balance the light with the brick. Sapphire, light, and brick. And the key is to integrate the lessons of the brick into the light of the sapphire. So that's the bottom line there. Thank you, everybody. Gemar Simon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.